This is the Wonder Life Podcast. I'm your host, Andrea Ritter. Each week, I interview game changers, thought leaders, and functional health and wellness experts to inspire us to light up our lives so we can go out and light up this world. You may follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Wonder Health, and that is Wonder with a U. This week, I'd love to highlight one of our amazing partners for the Gut Check Summit, Dr. Paige Mott, and her clinic, the Discover Life Chiropractic Wellness Center. She is an amazing doctor, just full of vitality and so much knowledge. She is a wonderful chiropractor, and she has different modalities that she uses to help people live their healthiest and best life. So, check out Discover Chiropractic in Loveland, Colorado, and Dr. Paige will be at the Gut Check Summit on April the 6th in the Wonder Life Wellness and Beauty Expo, so you're going to want to see her there and just enjoy a complimentary service that she has to offer and bask in the glory. So we'll see you on April 6th at the Gut Check Summit, and make sure to check out Discover Life Chiropractic. This week on the Wonder Life Podcast, I interviewed Dr. Scott Shannon, game changer and transformational leader in the field of psychiatry. He is using ketamine and MDMA to help treat people with treatment-resistant depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. In the podcast, we talk about the use of a ketamine trial that is really helping to change people's mental states. And this drug was approved this week by the FDA. So we are making huge strides for folks living with mental health issues. And hopefully those issues are going away. So if you listen to this podcast and you have any questions, please reach out to Dr. Shannon's office directly at the Wholeness Center in Fort Collins. We truly hope you enjoy the show and that this is a life-changing episode.
Yes. My background is I'm a psychiatrist and integrative physician. I've been involved in holistic medicine for 40 years now. I joined the American Holistic Medical Association in 1978 and have been working in the field since. But in the last 5 years, I've taken a very different direction in my practice. We're now involved in research working with MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. We're doing ketamine and ketamine-assisted psychotherapy in the office, and even looking at joining a trial for psilocybin for treating severe depression.
So can you tell us about what the different drugs are? So MDMA is, like they call on the street, like ecstasy, right?
Right. MDMA is known as ecstasy. Now, what's interesting about that medicine has been around for over 100 years. It's generic, but it was used in the 1970s and the first half of the 1980s by a number of psychiatrists and physicians around the country and therapists to assist and support psychotherapy. And I happened to be one of them working in Arizona. And then some people began to abuse it in nightclubs in the 1980s, and the DEA came in and scheduled it, Schedule 1, in spite of the evidence that it helped psychotherapy. And Rick Doblin formed an association called MAPS, Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, to try to get it back out in the healthcare place. And so for the last 30-some years, he's been working on that. And we've gone through phase 2 trials now, which were very successful. And the FDA gave us breakthrough status based on the evidence that after 3 treatments, 3 6 to 8 hour sessions with MDMA a month apart, people with severe, often decades-long PTSD, 58% no longer had the diagnosis 2 months later.
That's huge.
And then a year later, 67% no longer had the diagnosis. Even more people got better.
So you give the people the MDMA, and is this a guided process, so you don't tell them to go home and deal with themselves?
No one's going to go home with this medicine.
Okay.
And so they have prep sessions with us, like 6 hours of prep sessions before. Then they have an 8-hour-long session with a therapy team, co-ed therapy team, actually in this room right here. And we work with them for 8 hours.
Straight,
consecutively, while they're under the influence of the MDMA. And then if they're in good shape, which they typically are, we have a sitter who is there available for them while they spend the night. We come in the next morning, check them out. And if they're in a good place, they go home. We have roughly 6 more hours of psychotherapy over the next month, and they have their second session, another 6 hours of psychotherapy, and they have their third session, a few more hours of psychotherapy, and they're done. So they get 3 exposures to the medicine, and we're hoping that's all they ever need.
Wow. I have so many more questions about the MDMA. However, you mentioned 2 other vehicles, or I don't want to call it drugs just because I feel like that's a bad word, and these are
they're medicines.
Yeah, so this medication. So we're going to get to ketamine last, but what was the other one that you mentioned?
Psilocybin is also known, people know it as magic mushrooms.
Oh, okay.
And there's actually referendums around the country. The city of Denver is going to try to legalize it this year.
Really?
In a referendum. And there's also referendums pending in Oregon. So
for recreational use or for a doctor to?
Actually, it will be to decriminalize it for the general public. Because the feeling is that, you know, in some ways, medicines like psilocybin are actually kind of anti-addictive. And research shows that people that have used psychedelics are actually less likely to be addicted and less likely to be suicidal.
Wow.
So they look like they have a pretty good safety record, but the data coming out now shows that they can be very useful for people with end-of-life issues, such as dealing with cancer and terminal illness, and that one episode with psilocybin has been shown in studies to significantly help people dealing with terminal cancer.
Wow. What happens?
I think they see their life and life in general in a very different way. One of the things that psychedelics such as LSD, psilocybin do is they allow us to sort of see our world and even ourself without the filter, biases, fears, worries, etc. that we build up over a lifetime. And so that's one reason why I think it helps people with depression and possibly addictions, but also with end-of-life issues.
So the mushrooms are really helping people with depression, too. So so regardless of the medication, so LSD or MDMA or the mushrooms, it's to unearth maybe something that's stuck in our patterning, or like
Well, a couple things. MDMA is not a psychedelic.
Oh, it's
truly
not. Okay.
It's actually closer related to pseudoephedrine or even amphetamine compounds like Ritalin.
So a psychedelic is something that like alters the way you see things.
Yes,
more?
A psychedelic, okay. And it would be ayahuasca, psilocybin, LSD. They actually alter our sensory perceptions. They alter our sense of self. People with MDMA are very clear, coherent, very present in the room. Not true of people on psychedelics.
Yeah, they kind of go to the other dimension, if you will.
They go somewhere.
Or wherever they go.
Wherever they go.
Right. Wow. So let's talk about ketamine. And what that is and how you are using that and how long have you been treating your patients with it?
So ketamine has been around it was created in the 1960s. It was approved in the U.S. in 1970 and is probably, if not the most used medicine in anesthesia, one of the most used, probably top 3. It's a World Health Organization essential medicine around the world. It's our best avenue for treating people in the battlefield or treating people in a third world country. It's used in every emergency room and every operating room. If a young child comes into an emergency room with a cut on their head, they're likely going to get an injection of ketamine so the doctor can sew them up. And then 40 minutes later, the kid's fine. And
so it's like a painkiller?
Well, it's a dissociative medicine.
Okay.
So if you've ever had nitrous oxide at the dentist's office, you know, you're present, you're awake, you're clear, you're alert, but you're in a different place. You're not really in your body. It dissociates you out. And so because of that, less pain issues. So it's used, but it's also can be used to help get people ready for anesthesia. And it's often used in combination with other medicines there. But in the last 15 or 20 years, we found out that people that get an injection of ketamine are less depressed, and often less depressed immediately or within hours. We don't really have medicines in psychiatry for depression that work like that. And studies coming out of NIMH and other places 15 years ago showed that it's very helpful for treating major depression. And in the last 5 years, we have a range of studies coming out showing that it's very helpful for treating people with severe resistant depression that's not responded to any psychiatric medicines. And they typically respond quickly and with very few side effects. It's quite a safe medicine. And people will come in. The typical routine for someone with severe treatment-resistant depression is they come in and get 6 infusions over 3 weeks, 2 a week for 3 weeks. The infusions last about 40 minutes. People find the experience very different, kind of surreal. It can get sort of like a psychedelic, but not classically in that way. People just seem to go to strange different places. But it also, because it takes the whole sort of cortical part of our brains offline, that's the part of our brain that tends to worry and experience fear. It's the part of our brain that has negative thoughts and ruminations about negative self-image. It's the part of our brain that gets us in trouble, really. It's something called the default mode network in the brain. Now, one of the things that we found is that meditation can actually help to control overactivity of the default mode network. And meditation actually has been shown to improve depression. The problem is that meditation can take practice and time, even years of practice, to become functional. But the people that are very good at meditation seem to be less and less bothered by depression. But ketamine accomplishes that same thing in 40 minutes. Now, the challenge with ketamine is that the results can be transient, that after a week or two or four or six, the depression can come back. So that's why we give a series of treatments and then often look at maintenance, sometimes sending people home with lozenges or inhalers. Johnson & Johnson is developing an inhaler that they hope to have on the market in the next year or two for ketamine.
Oh, wow.
It's a slight variation on the sort of generic ketamine, but we're using generic ketamine, and for the take-home use, it's very reasonable cost, like $50 to $70 a month.
So they get the infusion here, so it's going into their veins, and have their process, but you will send them home with either an inhaler or pills or
that's one of the options. If people have a substance abuse history, may not be a good idea. And that those folks, we may just encourage them to come back for maintenance sessions.
Just so you can kind of control and monitor
their because use. This drug has been a drug of abuse.
Is this the Special K?
This is Special K.
Okay, this is interesting. So, of course, it gets a bad name.
Yeah, and it gets a bad name because people like the euphoric effect of it. But the people that are using it daily and in high doses, it can be dangerous, and they're often abusing other things as well, and that's just sort of a long story. But there's not been cases of people going from psychiatric treatment to abuse that have been documented.
Fascinating. So how do you, so most cases with ketamine, you're treating depression and, or, you know, maybe some sort of a trauma?
Well,
or it just depends.
Generally for treatment resistant depression or severe suicidality. So let's say someone comes in and is acutely suicidal, says, they come into an emergency room, let's say, and they say, I want to kill myself. Life is not worth living. I'm despondent. I've just decided it's time to end it. Now, at that point, the emergency room doctor is going to sign a legal hold and transport them to the next available psychiatric bed. The problem is we don't have enough psychiatric beds, and sometimes these people can wait in the emergency room for 2 to 4 days while they're waiting for a psychiatric bed. And often the psychiatric hospitalization just layers on more medication that they've already been using or have failed with, sends them home, and it may buy a week, but sometimes that's all it buys us. Now we have a lot of physicians, some in the emergency room, even emergency room docs, who are giving people a ketamine infusion right there in the emergency room so they can send them home, get them back into therapy, get them into their psychiatrist's office, and save the hospitalization.
That seems really like cutting edge, like really potentially life-saving.
I know, think about all the other fields of medicine. They have acute interventions they can do for life-threatening illness. I mean, if you come in with a deep wound, laceration with blood loss, acute appendicitis, fulminant infection, there are things we can do that will make you safe. And in psychiatry, we've just said, well, maybe we can get you in a place where we can have people watch you closely. And in spite of that, people will still kill themselves.
Yeah.
So it's a good temporizing measure. And the challenge with ketamine is really let's find out ways to make the effect endure over time.
So what happens when the ketamine goes into the bloodstream and hits that spot in the brain? Like, what creates that relief?
Well, we don't know. One way to think about it is because the patient dissociates, they go to some place. They're not in the room, and typically when someone's deep in an infusion, you can talk to them, and they really won't respond much, if at all.
So is it kind of like a heroin, sort of?
No, it's closest to nitrous oxide.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, in terms of the dissociation. But people will disconnect, they'll go far away, and I suppose if you were to shake them and speak real loudly to them, they'd probably respond in some way. But the nice thing about it is that it doesn't decrease breathing like opiates, like heroin does. And that's why 60,000 people are dying every year of opiate overdoses, mm-hmm. is because if you take too much fentanyl, too much heroin, you will stop breathing and die. But not the case with ketamine. It doesn't depress breathing or heart rate. And that's why they can use it in third world countries or in a battlefield for someone who's had their leg blown off by an IED.
So they can just disconnect from that.
The medic or even their sergeant can give them an injection of ketamine until help can get there.
Wow. So that's like something that like the armed forces or the military has on hand to manage.
It's one of their frontline tools.
Wow. So why did you start this part of the journey of using some alternative medications or drugs to help your patients?
I've become convinced that our current tools in psychiatry are not all that effective, and recent studies have shown that, for example, around the world, depression will become the number one disabling illness in the next few years. In the United States, in spite of using more psychiatric drugs than any country in the world, our mental health indices are falling in the wrong direction. Suicide rates have increased by 25 to almost 30% in the last 20 years. And major depression, even our best study in the STAR-D study of major depression, the best we can often do is hope for 30 to 40% treatment response. And as many as 60 to 70% of people that we treat for depression will have no significant or sustained relief. And they're often coming back to their psychiatrist every month or two, hoping for a better combination. And what we're finding is that the chemical imbalance theory of depression is really not very valid, according to the scientific community. And our medicines for treating depression are just not very good.
So what do you think's going on with people? Why are people experiencing so much distress that then leads them to having depression over, you know, long periods of time?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons. It's kind of a perfect storm in this country. So we have deteriorating nutrition over the last 40 to 50 years. For example, our intake of magnesium and B vitamins and omega-3 oils is fallen away. Those things are needed for brain health. We have people getting less sleep, more electronic stimulation. There's less community, less family resources and relationship support close at hand. People are more disconnected than ever. I think there's a lot of reasons for it. I think financially it's a tougher time. You know, for the 1% or 2%, times are good, but for everyone else, they're struggling and it's not getting easier.
Mm-hmm. And that just puts people into like that circular thought process and like kind of digging themselves into a hole, whether they know it or not.
Yeah, and there's actually even some thought now that psychiatric medications may predispose people to having chronic problems with it. So I've just over time, for example, some recent studies out about psychiatric meds show that what are called neuroleptics or antipsychotic medicine that are used increasingly widely in children and teenagers have actually a lethality. They're 3 to 4 times, they will increase the death rate 3 to 4 times in children and teenagers. This data just came out last month.
Oh my Lord.
And most of those medicines are used for behavioral control, not for psychosis.
So why is that okay? Like, why are we able to have something like that on the market? Like,
it's desperation. People are desperate. You know, I know as a child psychiatrist, there's desperation everywhere. People are desperate. Doctors are desperate. We have less and less resources and supports as a society. It's going in the wrong direction instead of more supports and more tools and resources for people. It's less and less each decade.
So what can we do? How can we change this? How can we have a shift in consciousness around all this stuff? Because what you're saying, I mean, I get that. It makes perfect sense. How can we change?
Well, there's a number of things that we can and should do. I mean, one of the things that I often talk about is using symptoms as sort of a call to action rather than a call to medication.
I like that.
So if someone's anxious or depressed or not sleeping, then we need to look at their life, their relationships. We need to look at their diet. We need to look at their educational work setting that they're involved in. Are they supportive? Are they stimulating? We need to look at their abuse history. We're finding out more and more that high numbers of our population have had a distant trauma that they may not be fully aware of, but that is driving their need for medical help and support. For example, there's something called adverse childhood experiences, which typically means, were you physically, emotionally, or sexually abused as a child? Did you grow up with neglect? Did you grow up with an alcoholic or an addict? Did you grow up with a felon in your home? There's a whole 10 different questions. And if you answer 7 yeses on this questionnaire, your likelihood of being chronically ill, chronically depressed, or chronically suicidal, or an addict are increased many times over. It's our best predictor of high utilizers of the medical and psychiatric system. And we're now realizing that we don't have good treatments for trauma. Our current treatments for trauma, like Zoloft and Paxil, are really quite ineffective. That's why MDMA is so exciting. This may be, fingers crossed, and if this all pans out with our phase 3 studies, the first time that we've really seen an effective cure in psychiatry for a serious brain-based mental
illness. That's amazing. Now, tell me this before we wrap up. At what age are you using, like, because you see a lot of kids, and I'm assuming you see adults as well.
Yes.
At what age would you use any of these alternative? They're not even alternative. What the medications we've been talking about?
Well, ketamine, we're predominantly using it with adults. I've treated a 17-year-old. I'm open to looking at younger people for ketamine, but predominantly the use is people who've been depressed for decades.
Okay.
They're often in their 40s, 50s, 60s, even 70s. Had a 70-some-year-old patient today.
And are your patients open to this, or do you kind of have to, you know, not coax them into it, that's not the right word, but do you have to provide them with a ton of information, or are they just like at the end of the road and they're like, please?
You know, been depressed for 20 years and have failed 10 or 15 different psychiatric medicines and spent tens of thousands of dollars on psychiatrists and psychiatric medicine, have been in psychotherapy often for decades. They're eager. They search this stuff out and they track us down. We're probably one of 4 or 5 centers in Colorado now doing ketamine infusions. I think there's 2 or 3 in Boulder, two or three in Denver, and we're based in northern Colorado here. But there's now 1,000 physicians around the country doing ketamine infusions. So I don't find that I need to convince. In fact, what I find is just the opposite. I find that maybe 1/3 to 1/2 of the people that come in to see me for a ketamine evaluation, I recommend that they don't go on ketamine because I don't feel like they've gotten good care yet.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they've looked at their diet. I don't think they've had perhaps good psychotherapy. They may not have had the right medication. So it's not the first thing we go to, but we think of it as a very good treatment option.
So you want to give them a good foundation before you would take them to that step.
So that with ketamine, and now we found that ketamine-assisted psychotherapy is sort of the next realm that we're exploring at this point. And I've been using ketamine in my practice for probably 5 years, using inhalers and then lozenges, and probably for 3 years doing infusions. But in the last year, we've got into doing ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, where we either give someone an injection of ketamine in my office here, and we often look for more of a high-dose experience to give them more of that life change, sort of shaking the snow globe, if you will, just trying to give them a reboot, a restart. Or we give them lozenges and they work with one of our therapists and doing a 1 to 2 hour psychotherapy session. We're finding that ketamine has the ability to quiet down the trauma center in the brain, the amygdala, so that people can actually process through their trauma, sort of in the same way they do with MDMA. I don't think ketamine is near as good as MDMA, but MDMA is clearly right now a controlled Schedule 1 substance and very limited in our studies. We have, in this location, 20 to 25 slots for this Phase 3 study. There'll be 200 to 250 worldwide. And we have 50 to 70,000 people on the waiting list for it.
Oh, my God. That's insane.
It is insane.
But it's amazing that this is happening so that you can help all these people.
Well, they're hoping to roll out MAPS. The sponsor of the study is hoping to roll out what's called expanded access or compassionate use, which means the FDA would allow us to treat people with severe trauma outside of the study itself. So we're hoping that will take place in the next 6 months. And, you know, the difficult part of that is because it involves 50 so hours of therapy by 2 different therapists. I mean, that's 100 hours of therapy. Even if you use a guideline of $100 an hour, that's $10,000.
Yeah.
So this therapy will not be cheap. But for people that are totally disabled by PTSD, it may be life-saving.
This could be a huge, huge game changer.
That's what we think.
Well, I really appreciate you and your brilliance and just shining the light and really, I mean, living your purpose. I'm telling you, I'm seeing your purpose, but just helping all these people who, you know, could otherwise have a debilitating life. And it's like life's too good to not enjoy it. So thank you for all of your amazing work over these years.
Well, we're excited about what we're doing here, and with all the colleagues that I work here with, that Dr. Craig Heacock, another psychiatrist, Jason Sinknick, and others, we're really, I think we're making a prominent statement about where psychiatry can go in the next decade.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amen.
Amen. Happy to be here.
Thank you. I appreciate you.
My pleasure.